Welcome back to the Mini PC Show. My name is Brian, and this is episode 80. I have the Flying Rich and Door-to-Door Geek with me, guys. How are you today?
Doing good, and good to be with you again, man. Did you have the first frost yet in Boston?
Yeah, we had the first frost, a week ago.
And are you a Red Sox fan?
Well, I think if you're born in Massachusetts, you're automatically a Red Sox fan.
So yesterday was a good day.
Yeah, yesterday was an awesome day.
Oh, good, good. Hey, you know what the first frost in the north means?
What's
it's,
that?
It's finally below drenched sweating weather here in Florida.
Oh, that's right.
It's like, fall's coming. It'll only be 70-something, high 70s.
When my kids woke up this morning, I said to them, yeah, the Patriots beat the Brooklyn Dodgers last night. Dad, it's the Red Sox. They're not playing in Brooklyn. That was pretty funny.
Very cool, very cool. Here it just became jacket weather. And to be honest, if there's any way that I like to dress more than others, it's jacket weather, which at least thankfully I get to do twice a year.
Yeah, I don't mind wearing the occasional sweater. I mean, I can't. I've lived down in Florida for a little while and not having the seasons. It didn't bother me at first until I came back. I'm like, yeah, you know what? I kind of miss wearing the occasional sweater or the jacket, just being hot all the time.
Well, I heard a funny line. So the funny line goes, the leaves don't change color here, but the license plates do.
That's so true.
Seems very true.
Yeah.
Well, I'll first say, do you want to talk about the elephant in the room? And no, people, it has nothing to do with the Raspberry Pi, because the Raspberry Pi is not doing anything remotely exciting. It's like they're on Valium or something. We have other actual news in the mini PC world.
Which elephant in the room are you going for, Dor?
Oh, first I'll say, Brian, you're like continuously transmitting and you're bumping stuff. But the big news in the room is the Odroid H2, which we actually heard rumors about almost a week ago that supposedly Odroid as a company was looking at doing a Intel-based solution.
Yeah, sure. So apparently they've had another run at it. I forget what it was called. It wasn't the H2. It was something X2, I think it was, like 2 years ago. And I don't know how successful or failure-based it was. Now, here's the interesting thing that I've actually had this conversation yesterday, or was it Monday, that Odroid is one of my favorite manufacturers because something like the Odroid XU4, I consider the gold standard of something other than a Raspberry Pi. It's hardworking. I've had zero issues with. Has a lot of compatibility out there. A lot of different OSs run on it just fine. So I was telling people, you know, if you're going to buy something other than a Raspberry Pi, I would get an Odroid. And I'm hoping the same is going to be true about the x86 board.
I'll say first, to me, the most important factor, whenever you mention the word Intel, is what's the price of this puppy? Well, first, let's say it's an Intel Celeron Gemini Lake J4150, which is not a brand spanking new processor from what I read. And it's a Celeron processor, so it's not even a mobile i3. It's a Celeron, and the price tag is between $120 and $140. Which I'll say still isn't, it's still pretty fair. It isn't like crazily priced, but it's over $100. And once you get over $100, then to me, it becomes a little bit more of a decision to buy something. If you can convince yourself, at least to me, it's $70. It's much more of a on the whim, I want to support these guys kind of buy. When you go over $100, it then becomes, are you sure you want to spend this kind of money to me?
Okay. So the one, I want to go into the specs just yet. I want to, you know, banter about it a bit. One, a couple of podcasts ago, I talked about ARM is the future, and you know that's something Dor's been saying for a long time because Samsung is the world's largest microprocessor builder, and that because ARM is out there in such quantity and so many people are manufacturing it, because ARM is running on a license. So ARM, the company, which I believe is a British corporation, licenses out the technology to other people to manufacture. It's kind of like the PC world when you have clones. So the reason we're all not using an IBM PC right now, well, it wasn't that IBM licensed it, that it didn't actually work out that way. But basically, there's a bunch of other people building similar type of products that would run this on the platform. Anyhow, so Dor mentioned earlier today in our chit chat that he didn't want to pay the Intel tax. And basically, anything Intel always comes with a little bit higher price tag than something with ARM on it. And actually, this could have been an AMD, right? It didn't necessarily have to be Intel.
True.
So, yeah, if it was AMD, maybe it'd be better. There's a whole bunch of things, and I kind of can't resist going into the specs on this, but it has dual Ethernet. So what that means is you could run it as a router. So what is the router software that everybody goes crazy over?
PFSense is the
PFSense,
one.
Thanks. PFSense, you could run on this. Like, PFSense runs on an ARM box, but it's their proprietary box, and they don't release the code. But you can get PFSense, download it, run it on this, which I think is kind of exciting if you want to use a PFSense box.
Well, Intel, I don't want to say bad, but I do think if it was AMD-based, we would have had a better opportunity to get a higher bang-to-buck ratio. Mm-hmm. And the only reason I really say that is because if I'm Intel, if I classify Odroid as nobody threatening whatsoever, there is no way they can threaten anything because they're Odroid, then they're not going to hold back. But my logic is, wouldn't Intel want to keep their small form factor goodies
as a Nook?
Yeah, like ready for the Nook lineup, not for somebody else to take advantage of.
Yeah. And so as a VMware guy, I've been thinking about setting up a cluster in with vSAN. And the way to do vSAN, which is a virtual storage area network, is you need three devices. And I was like, ooh, well, I have one already if I get two of these. And so part of that is you have to have both a SATA drive, you know, a spinning disk, and an SSD, like an M2. And this has two SATA ports and an M2 port on it. So I'm like, ooh, okay. So I was pricing out a Celeron Nook, and it'd be $500 for like 32 gigs of RAM. Oh, all right. So the price on this is supposed to be in the $130 range, and you can add your own. What form factor is the memory? Is it DDR4 DIMMs?
It is a dual channel DDR4 PC 19200.
Okie dokie.
So 32 gigs of RAM max, which I will say, 32 gigs of max RAM on a board like this is maybe 10 times more desirable to me than the processor.
Okay, so 32 gigs should probably cost you about $250. So let's see, $250, you could get a small M2 for like $50, and then you probably could get like a 2.5-inch drive for under $100. That's several terabytes. And speaking of which, I went to Costco today to pick up one of those 6-terabyte drives, the USB 3.0.
Sarge, we're breaking up there for a second.
Am I with you now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Unfortunately, I don't have the microphone on a bracket, and sometimes the movements translate into, you know, micro loss of connection. And then I got to go into the settings and change that, like reapply my settings. Anyhow, so the 6-terabyte drive that I wanted to pick up today is no longer available. And the only thing that's available is the 8-terabyte drive, and it's like $156, I think.
That still sounds fair-ish.
Yeah, but I don't want to spend $156. I'm not saying it's a bad deal. I'm just saying I don't want to spend $150. 6 terabytes is good enough for me.
Well,
I hear you. I was actually that way when I went to look for a hard drive, and I just didn't want to spend over $100. So I was satisfied with getting, I think it was 2 terabytes.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really need any more than that.
Yep. So One of my wish lists on this is if I picked up two of these and set them up with 32 gigs of RAM each, the SSD, you know, the M2, and a spinning disk, I could set up a home vSAN in my VMware lab.
I'll say because it's Intel-based, without sounding stupid, because it's Intel-based means virtually anything you can do on virtually any desktop or any laptop, you can do on this device because it's Intel-based.
Correct. For the most part.
Well, yes, but it matters. And that's what I'm going to say. Because with the HDMI that's on it, sometimes it's difficult to get that at the right resolution, at the right frame rate. And then sometimes if you want to do video over that, but audio over something else, it becomes a little bit cumbersome. There are little things that might sprout up. But to me, one of the best things about the board is because it's Intel-based, more than likely, you're just going to be able to run mainline kernels on it without any issue, which is the real big thing, is what I want to say. But because you have SATA connections, and you have the MVN connector, MVN, right? Yeah, NVMe. You literally can grow this thing. So if you wanted to, you could be cheap and just get the unit, a power supply, and a cheap old SATA hard drive in the beginning with 4 gigs of RAM, and start to use it and then build it up over weeks or months if you want that. To me, that's one of the best things I like about this board is scalability.
So now it does have an HDMI.
You there, man?
Am I there?
Yep.
Okay. So my idea is, hey, two display ports. Well, it has a display port, an HDMI port, and if I could tack this on the back of my monitors and use it as my thin client or pseudo thin client, I'd be the happiest person in the world.
Yeah, I mean, this is, to me, like, it can be the ultimate, I don't want to say thin client, because that's one hell of a thick, thin client.
Right, right. Yeah, you got enough horsepower to do some good things with it.
I certainly agree. You have a ton of horsepower. Now, you mentioned earlier having a software firewall or a router. This being an x86 platform does open up the avenue for a plethora of firewalls, in addition to, like you said, pfSense, but Untangled, Sophos, SmoothWall. And most of those platforms do run on x86 instead of ARM. And I get all geeky inside. And I said this earlier during our a chat when you first showed this to me earlier today. But just like you said earlier, having that the access to the NVMe storage, too, that's pretty huge, especially when in terms of firewall. So I would definitely drop $130, $140 for this device, even just the fact that it can do the NVMe storage.
Well, and I'll say, I'm going to say this just because I know there's somebody listening to this show who's saying this. The bad thing about having an Intel processor in there is you have an Intel processor in there. And we have just went through about 18 months of, it feels like 18 months, maybe it's only 6 months, I don't even know, of insane scalability of vulnerabilities like baked into the processors themselves, where they were basically shortcutting stuff to make their processors basically faster than they were supposed to be, kind of thing.
So you're talking about Meltdown and Spectre.
That is two of them. There is at least four more. Yeah, there's right. At least four more vulnerabilities. Two of them were on the NIC itself, which was over the Intel Pro VLAN thing, where even Gibson said to get maximum performance on his device, he had to disconnect LAN 1, which he believes LAN 1 is where all the default under channel traffic goes that he says he has no control over, kind of thing. So to go to NIC 2 is where you get your full speed. NIC 1 is preoccupied with this underlying operating system stuff.
Hmm.
So, I mean, but I'm just saying this because somebody has to say it. Now, with that said, I think the best thing then is if it is $100-something and it does have this type of Intel vulnerabilities, to replace it, hopefully they come out with another one and it only costs like $100-something and not $1,000-something like most servers.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. But the other thing is I've kind of argued at my last job with the security folk about Spectre and Meltdown and patching for it, because you have to be on the system to do it. And they came back with, well, what if somebody's using a browser on one of the servers? I'm like, they should be fired, you know?
Yeah.
because we actually intentionally held off. And it all depends on your own environment. If nobody's using a browser on the server, only smart people are using.
You there?
Am I there?
Yep.
That's so weird. So if only smart people or nobody uses a browser on a server, you're not going to have a Spectre or a Meltdown issue. You're not going to have somebody click on a stupid link they got in an email and, you know, payload something that would leverage the Spectre or Meltdown flaw in a server. That being said, you know, other environments may be different, and you could have, you know, Spectre and Meltdown issues if you don't have a controlled population using the equipment. So, yes.
Well, but, and correct me if I'm wrong, I honestly don't remember there being an actual in-the-wild caught exploit.
Right, and that was my other gripe with these guys. You know, the security guys getting all hot about it. I'm like, show me the infection in the wild. And,
right, yeah, I basically shook my security guy's hand and says, well, look, I first of all want to congratulate you for actually paying attention to this stuff, but let me reassure you, this is not an issue. You might as well stand on the top of the building and worry about aliens coming down.
Right.
So you guys bring up a good point. So the Odroid H2, would I use that in a enterprise environment, or would I use that in a small business environment? And to answer that question is probably not, and it all depends. So given the fact that it is an x86 platform, and it does have some vulnerabilities, like you said earlier, Dor, I probably would spend a little bit more money and put my dollars where the security is. Does that make sense?
Well, if you have a good firewall ahead of it, and then you don't have to worry about these issues. And if you the people behind the firewall aren't doing dumb things with it, you're pretty much good. For a large portion of my life, I've run without virus protection or antivirus. And I'm right. I do have.
I think I lost you again.
What's that? Can you say it again?
So for the most part, I don't use antivirus and just don't go bad places, and you don't have problems.
Well, yeah. What I'll say is, if I'm becoming something, I would say I'm becoming a anti-absolutionist. And when I say that, what I mean is there is no definitive one answer for anything that's ever asked in any point in time. So would I use this in a business type setting? Well, I think it could have a use case. I don't think it would be sitting on a rack with my most expensive data sitting right next to it, kind of thing. But I could see this, dare I say, Rich, edge computing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you ever watched the presentation I think I talked about on this show like 6+ months ago about edge computing, but this to me is a perfect edge computing type device. But it also can be brought in closer towards the data center just for management's sake. I can see this being a really super powerful console, master console for admins to use. Because one of the things about security that I tried to do at work, which they did not like, was instead of just having granting access to people and removing access, because that is actually bookkeeping and work and mm-hmm. maintenance and upkeep and all this. How about we do dedicated workstations that whenever someone logs in, everything is recorded, screen, keystrokes, and everything. And at the same time, we can then say, this time this guy was in this server, show me the email approving it. So all you guys got to do is just send emails back and forth approving it. Everything's stored up in the cloud, blah, 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 blah. And then that would be how we could audit our system and have a secure system. And this would be the perfect kind of hardware for me, I think, for such a device.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And like, dare I say, like smart displays, if you want the best digital signage you can with really crisp high-end video, this I would hope can do it because it's, you know, Intel-based and it has HDMI and DisplayPort.
So, okay, we haven't hit on the specs. So it's the Intel Celeron J4105 quad-core processor. It says up to 2.3 gigahertz. With 12 EU Intel UHD Graphics 600, which I don't even know what that is. Memory is the DDR4 PC19200 and up to 32 gigs of RAM. You got the M2 PCIe 2.0x4 slot, one NVMe storage, and two SATA 3.0, and eMMC flash. So they're giving you, you know, three ways of non-volatile storage. Video output, so it's HDMI, says 4K up to 60 hertz, DisplayPort 1.2, I'm sorry, HDMI 2.0, and DisplayPort 1.2, and that says 4K.
Yep, I think we lost you, Rich. Yeah, 4K, both of them at 60 hertz, which I will say, I like the fact that they both have the same specs.
Yeah, well, the question is, can you do both simultaneously at that speed?
That's a good question.
Because I hate to say it, because I've learned how manufacturers lie. You have audio, so HDMI has the audio on it, audio jacks for headphone and mic, and you also have the digital output, the SPDIF, dual gigabit Ethernet, which is a big deal to me, 20-pin header expansion with I2C UART 3.3 volt, real-time clock battery, and, oh, so they're including the power supply? Or is it, no, that's just saying the power input. So 14 volt to 20 volt DC power input. So it'll take anything 14 to 20 volts, which is cool. You might have an old laptop power supply kicking around that'll work with it. Somebody was quipping. I don't know what this dimension is, if it's any kind of a standard. So it's 110 by 43 millimeter. I think somebody was quipping that it wasn't the whatever form factor that's like 120 millimeter squared.
That's why I got a 3D printer.
Yeah, I mean, the up squared.
Anybody lost you?
So we've seen these Celeron Gemini Lake processors and other devices before, from beginning of the year when they were announced in. I hate drawing a blank. My mind's just totally mush. In Las Vegas, when they had announced at the Las Vegas show.
SES? CS?
SES, thank you. Thank you.
CES.
CES, thank you.
It's SEMA that's coming up. I had the S in my head.
I've seen these processors do very well in terms of gaming. So, and I'm not talking, you know, like your Android games and so forth. They do very well with that. But they do very well also with some of the high-end games, like Grand Theft Auto. Obviously, you have to turn your, you know, settings way down just to get a good experience, but they hold their own. And so, just having that kind of processing power in this little device with the dual 2 gigs of, 2 gig Ethernet ports, it's like, come on, Raspberry Pi community, you could be doing something else. And I know you guys don't want to get in that conversation, but I really enjoy the Odroid, and based on what they're doing here, and like you said, what they did with the XU4, they could be doing something like this. And I don't know why they're not. This is like so awesome that you have a device like for the enterprise market, for the small businesses. Yes, I do see a need. Maybe, like you said before, it all depends. But definitely for a house, you know, for your personal projects, your small builds, or like you said, the PF Sense box. I don't really think that will be a huge issue, being an x86. Platform, but security-wise, being for your house. But this thing is awesome. Why isn't Raspberry Pi doing something like this?
Well, I mean, the easy answer is because they don't want to. They don't want to be in this market. They don't want to be in that competition. They don't want to be in that market. I don't think it's smart of them to do that, but I'm pretty sure they would say something like that.
It's totally, and I'm a huge comic book fan. So it reminds me, it just reminds me of like Warner Brothers with their DC movies compared to what Marvel's doing. You know, it's like, guys, come on, let's get on the bandwagon here. Not so much of the bandwagon, you're already on the bandwagon. Let's get going. Like you said, it's like they're on Valium. It's so frustrating.
Yeah, and I'm going to have a link in the notes to basically a list of Amazon search results, where I just put in that processor. And you can see there's definitely Intel NUCs in there. There's definitely at least, I'm going to say, two computers that we brought on this show before. One was a B-Link, I want to say was one of them, and possibly the Gigabyte. But the Intel NUC is there, and Intel NUC I think is a trusted platform. Yep. I would love it if Odroid could become a trusted platform.
Right.
This HSYPC for $269 is looking pretty decent. 6 gigs of RAM and 128 gig of mSATA. Or is that, wait, let me make sure. Is that included? Integrates? And, yeah, looks like that's included. So it's got two HDMI ports. What were you holding up?
Yeah, what I'm holding up is my Zotac Z-Box, which is a computer I've had now for well in excess of a year, I want to say. And what I didn't notice is it has HDMI and DisplayPort just like in the same manner as the other board does. This was just over $200. It is definitely running an Intel Celeron of some magnitude. What I didn't realize, and here's what I'm starting to now become picky on specifications, is you guys know there's USB 3, USB 3.1, and then USB 3.2.
Oh, I didn't know there's a 3.2.
Okay, there is a 3.2. Basically, what you're looking for is the USB port with a little SS next to it. That doesn't mean Nazis. Okay, I'm saying it. What it actually stands for, legitimately, it stands for super speed. I'm not lying. It stands for super speed.
One of my NUCs has that.
Okay, then that USB transfer speed is twice as fast as USB 3.0. So it's basically like USB 6.0.
So in terms of bandwidth, what are we talking about? Megabytes per second.
6 gigs per second, I believe is what it said.
Okay.
So what do I got that plugs into it that transfers at that rate?
Ding, and that's weird. Now, this is the problem with something like that, because then we have other bottlenecks to worry about.
So,
and aren't those ports yellow, if I'm correct?
Yeah. On the back, they're blue USB 3.0 ports. And on the front, I honestly don't know why they're yellow, but they're indeed yellow. Yeah. And for all I know, they're USB 3.2.
Yeah, that's correct. So my i5 NUC has the same ports, and they're yellow. And I'm like, whatever, yellow. I didn't.
So I'm wondering, can you run an external graphics card on that bad liar?
I'll say this. I can almost guarantee you yes, but I'm also pretty sure you'd have to be running Windows 10 kind of thing.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, this has been my like pocket computer. This is as close as I can get to a pocket computer right now where I can take it back and forth to work and get some measurable horsepower. It's not great horsepower. Anything I do takes forever on the damn thing, but at least it's more powerful than a Raspberry Pi by far.
Right. Yeah, I know I was bashing on the Raspberry Pi earlier. I love the Raspberry Pi.
Well, that
I really do.
That's why I tell everybody.
I think we lost you again.
Go ahead, Rich.
What I tell everybody is if, like, maybe this is your first mini PC show and there's you're just getting into this, get a Raspberry Pi. Because your learning curve, everything is out there designed for the Raspberry Pi. And that, I'd be like, hey, get an Odroid XU4. If you know Linux, you know what to do, the Odroid, you're going to get a lot of good use.
Yeah, I mean, you have to get your feet wet kind of thing. And the community of the Raspberry Pi is so helpful and so supportive. It's the great first entry device. And without sounding dumb, it uses a power socket most people already have. You know, and all it is an HDMI cable away, and voila, you have yourself a full functioning computer, because SD cards are dime a dozen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you got some kicking around.
Right. Now, you mentioned the word community, and it really struck me for a minute, because I don't think I talked to you guys face to face just yet about the G Plus community going away. So, what do you guys take on that?
Google kill stuff.
Well, yeah. I'll also say this, they're not killing it, they're simply putting it behind a paywall. So it's still going to exist. It's just not going to be public facing. It's not dead. Two, it isn't happening for 10 months till next August, which here's my logic. It wasn't even, and I said this on a show recently, it wasn't even a data breach. People keep saying data breach. It wasn't a data breach. It was a API that had the potential to leak information. And from what they could tell, no one ever used it.
Right.
Thing. And then they immediately said, well, we're going to privatize Google Plus, blah, 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 blah. And it's taken, why would it be 10 months away? That's what I don't get. My logic is they're going to literally wait for that 10 months. And if somebody in their 20% time comes up with something worthwhile in that time, we're going to tell people go from that platform to this platform. That I don't see any reason for them to take that long to do what they're doing. So that's my excuse of why they're doing it. And so I'm going to be on hanging on that community till the bitter end, because it is the only place I've been publicly since the Podnuts forums where I'm not surrounded by people spitting venom from all directions.
Oh, yeah. I have to fully agree with you on that. I enjoy it. And I know there's quite a few out there, like other places you can join.
So, you know what's so funny about the Google Plus is it's kind of stealth. My office blocks all social media except Google Plus.
Oh. Because it doesn't count.
Because it right. doesn't count.
And that's the thing. There's nerds on Google Plus. Right. The reason it isn't blocked is because your admins are on it.
Very likely, yeah.
Well, that's why I'm posting questions half the time.
And because I get good answers back when I post questions. Yeah, so I'm not going on Diaspora. I'm not going on MeWe. I'm not going on Twitter. I'm not going on Mastodon. I'm not going on Diaspora. I'm not going on... I might go on Freedom Box if anybody ever puts a damn box up besides me.
And forget about Facebook.
You know, I almost don't use Facebook anymore, but I have been all over Instagram.
Yeah, I heard that's been very popular. I had it running for a little while, then I stopped.
So are you trying to be a influencer, Rich?
I've got 1,000 subscribers. Of course I'm an influencer. What do you mean trying to be?
Trendsetter.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you're right, Thor. I hope I have no idea. Something.
But here's the thing. There's no rush, people. Okay, we have other people on Google Plus with their own communities. To be honest, I want to see where they go. Kind of thing, because there's some pretty smart people I've seen on Google Plus post some damn good content.
Oh yeah,
kind of thing. So I'm in no rush. I got 10 months. You know what can happen in 10 months? A project can be spurred by a guy in a coffee shop in Dallas, Texas, next month. That by the time Google Plus does whatever it's going to do next August, could be the biggest thing that we're all already on because we have to be on it.
So here's the problem with social media. And one, it always changes. So originally it was MySpace and then Facebook.
Friendster first.
MyFace.
And we lost you again. BBS's. Well, first it was BBS's. You know, then it was like the private chats, and it was ICQ, and it was AOL Instant Messenger, and it was Trillion. And I mean, we can keep going. And then finally it was places like Friendster. Oh, my goodness.
So this is pretty fluid. They're talking about Facebook dying off, that the number of people on Facebook are going away. And you're right, there's a lot of venom. And unfortunately, there's people I like in person, but online, I can't stand them. And I had to stop following them or stop whatevering them. And so Google Plus has been a good community. But the problem with social media is name a video place other than YouTube. In
Vimeo.
So Vimeo is probably like 1-2% of the video market out there.
D2.
Yeah. So all of this stuff.
D2.
Oh, I don't care about percentages.
Right. But like I post my 2A content on gunstreamer.com. And if I get like 20 or 30 views, that's a good day. And also I could be number one. I could trending that day.
Well, I mean, YouTube is the number two search engine in the world. That right there is
and the number one
enough
is cool.
You have to know. Yes, right. And I want to say the last number I heard was well over 8-10 months ago, and it was 48 hours worth of content is uploaded to YouTube every second.
How do they slam enough hard drives into rack units?
Because they already have it there. Is the only way I can explain it. They already have the infrastructure sitting there waiting for stuff, is what I got to believe.
Massive.
Well, and I think we lost again. I sat on talks from Theodore So, T-H-O. So, I did his name. He basically works at Google, and his job is wide area file systems is the gimmick. And it's really hard to explain to normal folk what that even means. But instead of having a file system on a SD card or on a external hard drive or on a laptop or on
a SAN or a NAS
or a SAN or NAS, it's literally a file system that expands hundreds of miles. across thousands of devices, which to me, that's insane. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, but I'm sure it has something to do with that and a lot of money.
Yeah, it's really difficult to wrap your head around that.
I mean, back in the day, I remember Windows, I want to say it was 3.1, where I figured out I could compress my hard disk and get twice as much space out of it. And it ruined my damn hard drive.
Yeah, there.
So I don't know.
There was all sorts of memory caching things, like double your RAM and double your hard drive space by, you know, caching and compression. Which in the SAN and NAS business, we're still doing caching, compression, deduplication, all of that stuff to get the last dollar's worth out of your storage.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Were there any other links? I'll say, because there is a lot of frigging links. Everything from a Hackaday article with a article where you can literally build your own single board computer. We have Google unveils the Edge stuff. We have all kinds of stuff, I mean, in these notes, including Game Wizard, which just changed their policy. They were the best damn operating system for a Raspberry Pi to do classic games on ever, because what they used to do was you would, on line 706, you would click a link, go into search mode on the interface, and then you could type Mario or see a top list, what's hot right now, games. Single click, it would automatically download the game to your device, and then you would play it. They now changed how their operating system works to where it does not do any active searching. So now Game Wizard sucks and horrible, and you should never use it. Because I'm telling you, that feature to be able to just, you know, browse top lists, search things right there on the device, click a button, and then have it automatically download was the best damn thing I've ever seen in my life.
Sounds brilliant. Sign me up.
And apparently that's a good way to get a letter thrown at you by a lawyer, I'm going to guess. So is there anything else you guys saw? Because I tell you now, there's at least two things on my mind. One, I don't have it on me, is YubiKey. YubiKey is a very small, non-moving part hardware security token, is the way I put it. You shove it in a computer with a USB port on it, and it, you know, gets added to the computer as a human interface device, which means you can have the narrowest access and permissions on any operating system, including Windows. You can be the most limited of limited users, but you can still plug in this device and it will still be picked up as a human interface device, and it can be used as a keyboard. And they purposely do international things, so even if you stick it in a French keyboard, it's still going to work correctly, to where you put it in, you tap the button or hold down the button for 5 seconds, and one of two things comes out. They also have built-in NFC in them, which I'll say that then makes it to where you could use it on your phone as a security key as well. Well, I've seen more than a couple people in the past doing their own kind of hardware builds of small form factor devices, and I want to see if I can find somebody doing a YubiKey type solution that we can own ourselves and not have to pay a third party to do, is what I'll say. The other thing I got to mention really quick, because I keep forgetting to mention it on any show, it was line number 700. I said this on a previous episode, I believe, of this show. Somebody emailed me, can't remember who it is. Sorry, can't remember who you are. But this is what you need, people. This is the ultimate tool, where if you find, hypothetically, the Mini PC Show, and you say to yourself, self, I want to start listening to the Mini PC Show starting at episode 1, okay? You basically take the RSS feed, you go to cast-rewinder on GitHub, link will be in the notes. You put in the Mini PC Show and you click a button, and then they give you a new RSS feed. You then put that feed in and you'll get the show at its normal pace, like once a week, like it's a brand new show.
Oh, cool.
That's pretty cool.
I just think it's awesome for like podcasts, especially that are discontinued. There's no more episodes like Linux Reality, which if you haven't heard out there, you got to at least listen to one or two episodes. And it's from Chess Griffin at least 10 years ago now. He only did 100 episodes and he stopped. But the gimmick is you listen to the first episode and he talks about what is Linux and the creation of Linux. And some of the things he mentions are very much newsworthy even a couple months ago kind of thing. Really good podcast. Linux Reality. I'll have links to it in the notes. I believe it's now being stored on archive.org because that's where you put stuff when you want it to last forever. Because, you know, people lie through their teeth and say, once you put it on the internet, it's there forever. No, it is an idiot, because stuff can, every day, petabytes of information goes extinct and gone off the internet. Now, if you get it on the Wayback Machine or archive.org, same thing, then it at least has some assuredness of being there for a long, long time.
That sounds pretty cool, actually. Hey, I'm looking at line 712. Where'd you post this? It's the ClearCube C3 Pi. Looks like a thin client for your Raspberry Pi. Does that look familiar?
I don't even remember this now. I mean, I'm just going to the link. Oh, okay. Yeah, I know why I posted it. So when I went to VMworld, this will run the VDI. So basically the VMware Horizon View stuff basically gives you a virtual desktop and a PC desktop at that. So, and I forget, I think they have, is it free demo license? They're very reasonable price-wise on their software.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just very impressed. You know, I'm walking through and I saw a Raspberry Pi. I'm like, wait a second, I know what that is. I'm like, what are you doing with this?
Yeah, it looks like you can run VMware, Citrix, Amazon Web Services. That's right there. That's quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. So this is the whole concept of, you know, having a thin client but having a full Windows desktop, and that the desktop gets pushed out to your thin device, that it doesn't have to be a full-blown PC. And now, basically, the monitor costs more than the box because it's just a Raspberry Pi.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it looks like a Raspberry Pi that they're charging $120 for.
I think part of that's the license. I think it's, you know, Pi case and license all together.
Right.
So the license, because here's what I do not know, Rich, is why I'm asking. Virtual Windows licenses to run in any type of Hyper-V, hypervisor, whatever, is not cheap.
Well, that's still another issue. Yeah, your Horizon View, you have to handle the Windows licensing there for the desktop. This isn't for the desktop. This is just for the thin client.
Well, and you said software, so I'm going to guess that maybe there's other software that has to go on the VMware infrastructure?
So the Horizon View handles all of that. That's the VMware software, and then, you know, whatever you're pushing out. So if it's a Windows desktop. So this is just for the end client to be able to run it. And so this will run the thin client for it. So that's crazy cool. So you don't have to have a low-end PC. You can have a Raspberry Pi 3 there.
Very cool. Yeah, and Horizon, I do remember hearing about. It is newer, and I do believe it's going to be crazy popular when it actually people realize what it is, kind of thing, and what it can do. I will say, I understand now in hindsight why that virtual Windows license costs so much damn money. It's because the maintenance costs and the upkeep costs and everything that goes along with it is so much less. Because if you set it up right, you can literally blast Windows updates and update the entire enterprise of 3,000 plus virtual desktops in a matter of seconds, right, if you set it up right. So I understand why it's expensive. I do like the idea of this type of interface, just because it's a more controlled environment. You know, when it comes to like data loss prevention kind of mentality, it isn't like people can easily plug other stuff up to this, and you could even embed this in the wall if you want, so people cannot just plug things into an interface. So $120, if I was an enterprise, I would definitely be entertaining the idea of it.
Oh yeah, this is, if you have the VMware infrastructure, you have the Horizon View, this is definitely a very cost effective, or probably the best cost client that you can have.
So I wonder what the performance is like. Is it laggy, slow, choppy?
It would be identical to whatever other device you have, because realistically it's just rendering the UI.
Well, yes, but the bottleneck in this would be
the network.
The NIC port, because I'm pretty sure the network that's running on will be able to do at least 100 meg mm-hmm. with no problems. But on the Raspberry Pi 3, it's not a gigabit NIC. Right. So that's going to be your bottleneck. How tight is that compression on their algorithm? And here's what we can answer. How tight is their compression on both ends to be able to go past that one bottleneck? Because it's going to be that bus on the Pi with the NIC on it, which is shared with the USB port. If they have that compression tight, you could get good stuff. You're not going to get 4K, like full screen video. No way. Unless you know one frame a second's okay. But I would expect you to get good performance out of it, is what I'll say.
So, which I can't remember anymore. The Raspberry Pi 3 has the gigabit Ethernet port that's doing 200 meg.
Now, there's no Raspberry Pi anything with anything gigabit on it whatsoever.
I forget what it is, how they use the term gigabit, but it has like gigabit compatible hardware, but not the bandwidth.
Yeah.
I thought they were able to increase the bandwidth to at least 200 megs or something like that. I was reading some notes somewhere.
That's the baud rate of the USB hub.
Yeah, so it's still constrained by the USB hub that the Ethernet port's attached to.
So, link speed-wise, if I connect this up to another gig interface, is it going to come up as a gig, or is it going to link to a link speed at 100 meg?
I would guess the tester would register it as a NIC, but then if you actually do a like flow test, you'll never get it.
Right. No, I understand that. I'm wondering how... what the link speed is going to be.
Yeah, if I was home, I'd plug in and look. Tell you if the switch tells me it's a gig speed. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, and I'll say this seems like a very reputable company. If you take a look at their other thin clients, they have ridiculously specialized thin clients to where if you need more expandability locally or more power locally, they really do have a wide range of products. So this is just another one of their devices in their product line to fit a certain need.
Right. Yeah, this does look actually pretty cool. And given what your use case is, I can definitely see this filling a need.
Very cool.
I said that.
Very cool, guys. I will say that I don't know if I mentioned this before, but the Logitech K400 is my go-to keyboard for mini computing or home theater PC is the way that I put it. And it was line 713 in the notes. I'll first say for you guys here and the video watcher, there's a RII mini keyboard, which I really and honestly can say is maybe the worst damn purchase I've ever made.
I was
going to
say, does it
keyboards.
Come with a stylus?
It is almost unusable only because of one reason. I've used so much better. The mouse buttons are right below the trackpad, which means you have to take your finger off the trackpad to do the mouse click, which is very bad design is the way I put it. Keyboard I like is the K400, which has an actual mouse button up here opposite corner from the trackpad. So with one thumb, I can be on the trackpad, other thumb be on the mouse click, and it's just easier. Mm-hmm. Well, they're making a brand new version of it, the K600. Anybody who's ever used this keyboard said it's the best keyboard. How can you make it better? Then I show them the new one that's coming out, and they all agree, oh, wait, that does look
a little
better.
Is this Bluetooth? Yeah, what's the connection?
It is Bluetooth, but it is a dedicated dongle, which I've found makes a big difference. If you do not have a dedicated dongle with your Bluetooth device, the likelihood of the encryption, in air quotes, being a simple Xorg, is almost 80%+ of the devices out there. So if you have any security in mind whatsoever, you cannot just use built-in Bluetooth. You have to have like a dedicated dongle for it to use. So it just fits in the back of the keyboard. You just pull it out, plug it in your device, and it just works like butter, which first time setting up on a mini PC and stuff does make it a lot easier because you don't got to go, you don't have to worry about any pairing.
So $69.99, that's like,
Oh, I know. It is definitely pricey for a keyboard. The current one, I will only buy on sale when I find it for like $20 because it's normally $40. So with this, I'm not buying it for $70. I'll wait till I find it on sale for like $35. Then I'll buy like three of them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And just talking about TV, I don't know if I mentioned this on the last show, but I trimmed down my TV package, and I got YouTube TV to fill in the gaps, and I'm just loving that YouTube TV.
Yeah, it does fill a need. YouTube TV is pretty cool.
Well, the cool thing is it's every device everywhere except Fire Stick.
Wah, wah.
So, which meant...
Yeah, those they don't get along very well with one another.
Yeah, I'll say I'm literally going to get this keyboard quick. I'm not going to say day one, but I'm definitely going to get it quicker just because there's little doubt that it would make everything I do on my home theater PC much quicker.
Yeah, I'm looking at this design, and for those who haven't seen it yet, it looks like just a gray rectangle. The keys are in a round shape, and they're packly tight. They're tight with each other, but they're not too tight where you can't rest your fingers completely, it looks like. And then it has the touchpad on the far right-hand side and like a small circle with a navigation button right above it. So actually, you can kind of rest your right hand, your right palm, right against the edge of that trackpad, and you can just use your navigation buttons like you would almost like a small remote to navigate your screen if you're looking at like a, what do you call it? I was about to say XPMC. a media center. Gosh, like I said, my brain's mush. I can't remember anything half these days. Oh my gosh, I'm horrible. But anyways, just to get back on this keyboard, I wouldn't mind spending $70 on this keyboard. I hear where you guys are coming from, that you can definitely probably get this keyboard a little cheaper, but given the way it looks pretty hot. I mean, you really have a lot of short keys on it, arrow keys, volume tracker, it looks really nice. I wouldn't mind dropping $70.
And it both has a backspace and a delete.
Yes. And here's the gimmick I like about it. It does have arrow keys, but the arrow keys are the half-height keys, which I hate. But they make up for it, because in the top right corner, there's basically a directional pad that I'm sure is nothing more than just more arrow keys. In the opposite side of the touchpad, you have left-click, right-click. Now you have two separate buttons. You also have home, back, menu, and search for like Android-type interfaces. As you can see right next to the space bar, you see that there's different modes you can put it in. So you can put it in Windows mode, you can put it in Apple's mode, or you can put it in Android mode. All the function buttons by default are not function buttons, but they're, you know, play, pause, volume. To do F6 or F3, you would have to hold down the function key, which I'm usually also against big time. But in this instance, it really does make sense. It does say that the touchpad can do like two-finger scrolling, which is nice. You can also tap on the screen, on the touchpad, which I'm able to do both of them now on my touchpad, I believe. I'm just a fan of this, period. The interface makes the experience. I'm a firm believer with home theater computing. The interface and your experience with the interface drives whether or not you're going to use the interface or not. If it sucks, it's bumbly, it's stumbly, and you got to click 55 times, it's not, you're going to do anything else.
So here's the thing that I noticed. I'm looking at the specs on here. The way you can use this thing, wireless range about 50 feet away. I know you said it was Bluetooth, but they also have unifying as well, too. So I don't know if you guys noticed when you do buy a Logitech devices, whether it be a mouse or a keyboard, and it has that little star on the top of your receiver. So with the software app, if you have a Windows machine, you can actually retune your keyboard or mouse, given that the receiver has the little star on it. So if you end up losing that receiver and you tend to have one from an old mouse that broke or whatever, and you just didn't throw it away, you can, with the software, you can go to Logitech website and download the software to your Windows machine and retune this receiver that'll work with any of the Logitech mouse and keyboards. So you probably might be able to use a wireless device other than Bluetooth with your Windows machine.
I had no idea. Mind blown.
Yeah, and it's a permanent fix, too. I actually ended up losing one of my receivers, and I pulled one out of my old mouse I was not using, stuck it into my machine, retuned it. It worked perfect. And then I found the receiver. I said, oh, there it is. And I plugged it into another machine. Did not work with that mouse. So it's a permanent fix. You can retune it if you want to and go back and forth. But once you tune it, it doesn't go to any other receiver.
Uh-huh. I was curious about that. I was wondering how that worked.
Gotcha, gotcha. And I'm going to add this because some people were mad when they found this out. I like it. The power source is not a rechargeable battery. It's not a built-in battery pack. It's actually two AAA batteries. I will say, in the keyboards I've had the batteries in them for well over a year, probably 18 months, and I still haven't had to change the batteries. The batteries seem to last forever.
Yeah. Yeah, I really enjoyed the Logitech keyboards and mice. And this looks like a good buy, the K600.
Yeah, and it says that it's actually like default compatible with a good amount of TVs, which, okay, yeah, I guess mind blown. I wasn't ready for them to say that. You know, Christmas is coming up, and I got to ask the wife for something. Even though it's my money anyway, I can like feel like I'm tricking her into spending full price. I think I found my Christmas present. Very cool. So were there any other notes? Things you guys saw that you want to talk about?
Actually, something not on the list. One of the things I've been thinking about doing, and I did mumble chat this with you. I want to do OpenCV for facial recognition for my security cameras around my house, and I haven't done it yet because I'm not home, but I'm wondering if a Pi will handle processing the stream and be able to do facial recognition, or I need better hardware for that.
I mean, it's really hard to say. And here's the, I have to go with my assumptions. I have to assume something. And my assumption is the technology isn't that old. Because the technology isn't that old, I would doubt that it's really well optimized is my logic. So if I had to put money on something, I would venture to say if it would run on the Raspberry Pi, it would run quite poorly.
So an article I read said one frame a second.
Ooh, that's pretty poorly. Yeah.
So there's two things. There's two things I want to gain in my home security system is facial recognition, meaning, hey, that's a human face. And the other thing is, hey, that's a family member. That's my wife, my daughter, or me. And because motion detection is worthless if you have anything called wind and vegetation. So I would like to upgrade my...
I lost you again.
I can hear you.
I think Dor-
Richard,
yeah, I think Dor just says that to make me do things.
No, I think you're hearing
it. Yeah, you're probably hearing me through the chat.
Oh, yeah, that's
right. So, basically, motion sensing on the home security system is worthless because everything moves and everything would be detecting motion. But I want to be able to detect, like, a license plate or a face or a family member's face. Those are the three things I'm going for.
Ooh, the license plate. That's very interesting.
Yeah, OpenCV does that also. So OpenCV can do facial recognition and license plate recognition.
I like that one. Hey, open things up. I never thought about that, actually.
I honestly never heard of OpenCV before. It stands for Open Source Computer Vision Library. New to me, but if it can do the kinds of things like reading letters and facial recognition, then I want to see it get better because I want these technologies that companies, industries, and we use for facial recognition to be more open than closed.
Well, one of the things I'd like, because I was looking at the new NVR setup and also the same manufacturer makes some cameras that are wireless, is that I can put it at the head of my driveway because there's, you know, a choke point on my property where you enter. So this way I can see all the vehicles that would be entering my property. And, you know, hey, maybe it's the mailman or the UPS guy dropping something off. So I actually know that something is there. And I'm not necessarily talking nefarious security stuff. I'm just talking, hey, I get a notification when I get a package. Mm-hmm. Or my wife's home, my daughter's home, that kind of thing.
I think lost again. Yeah.
So do you have your heart set on the Raspberry Pi or can it be another device?
It could be any device. That's why I was kind of looking today, because I have the up board, the up squared, wondering what kind of hardware I can do, you know, that type of detection on.
Yeah, I was thinking about the up board as well, too. Or the UDU. I think UDU has a nice board, which is x86 platform, actually.
Yeah, or, you know, some of the retired laptops that I have that are x86 running Ubuntu now.
Dude, I'm going to tell you, I love repurposing old laptops, even though I know that they're using much, much more power than these mini computers. The simple fact that it has a built-in battery backup for at least some length of time, I just
Yeah,
love.
that's you can't beat that. I agree.
Well, that's another thing I wanted to try was Chrome OS on some of my older machines and see how that goes.
Well, okay. I guess you now think you have magic powers?
Well, I've seen a couple of articles on like a vanilla version of Chrome OS.
Hey, well, A, no. You will never, can never, and are not going to get any Chrome OS. It is the most closed proprietary thing that Google does. Unless you're a hardware manufacturer, you're not going to get Chrome OS. Chrome OS comes with certain hardware requirements that make it unbelievably secure. All you get when you download something like Neverware or something like that is you get as light of a Linux as possible, minus all the security features that come with Chrome OS, and then you get a Chrome browser that automatically boots up. So nothing you run is going to look at you and say you're a Chromebook. It's just going to think that you're just a Chrome browser. So, I mean, you can do stuff, but you got to be aware there's no backup, there's no security. Do not count on updates in a regular, timely fashion like normal. It's going to do whatever it
Updates.
wants to
Okay, that's
do.
another thing I didn't think about.
Yeah, and like right now there's a brand new feature I asked Rich to look on his Chromebook for called Better Together. I'm not really sure what it is, and it also sounds like something that begins, that's the beginning of somebody overtaking the world, I'm just saying. But Better Together, it popped up on my Chromebook and asked me to, do you want to be better together connected with your phone? Do you want better connectivity with your phone? I was like, okay, yeah, sure, I guess. I hit the button and then it said waiting for verification, and it would never complete verification with my phone. But if there's some sort of connectivity, ubiquity, data going back and forth
So on
between
my
the two.
Chromebook for search, when I typed in better, it says better call Saul.
No, you well, A, you have to get the update, and then on boot it asks you, do you want to be connected together? You can try to go into your Google settings and just look for connected, and you should see connected devices if you have it available to you. If not, I always encourage people go to Chrome settings about and check for updates. I have to check for updates manually a fair amount of times on my Chrome devices, but and to be sure that you're running the most latest version. But I mean, we've already gone on for about an hour, so I'm going to end with very bad news.
Uh-oh.
Very, very bad news that I don't know if you guys picked up on at all, because not many people did. I had one person ping me and ask me if I saw this, and when I said yes, they were like, this sucks so bad. Line 723 in the notes. Is a hyperlink to a website nobody, none of us has ever heard of. And if you go there, it literally looks like it's something from the 90s. Okay. It's called UPU.int. This is the Universal Postal Union. There is a contract that governments have with the
Oh,
UPU
jeez.
that enables cheap and low-priced shipping across
I always
certain
wondered how
countries.
that
Like, it's
happened.
going to. Yeah, well, these people kind of like put it together. So here's the example I use. To ship something from the United States to hypothetically Kenya, let's say it costs 10 bucks. I ship the same thing to the UK, cost me $2. I ship the same thing to Pakistan, cost me 55 bucks. It's the gist of it. Where even though the actual cost to move things around the globe, those prices didn't make sense, it does make sense because these people basically made agreements with countries on base rates and base prices and things like that. And there's been tensions with this in the last couple weeks, and we don't know if it's going to survive, but there's an agreement in place right now where if it gets broken, for our devices from Hong Kong, from our devices from Thailand, from our devices from Singapore, from our devices from, we got a couple from was it Denmark, which the upward, and then the Q box from Israel, they will all cost some magical amount of more money. I have no idea what that money is. Nobody does, I think, but it's just to be aware. So if you were contemplating buying 20 Raspberry Pis and you didn't want to buy it from a US person because it took too long or whatever, and you wanted to buy it overseas, you might want to do it now versus in 3 months.
Jeez.
Well, I mean, you know, the only constant is change. I'm not going to lie, people. We lived the sweet life for a really long time, being able to go to sites like Alibaba and buy things. I don't want to say cheap, but unbelievably affordably, and get them shipped here for next to nothing. Granted, the tracking sucked. We didn't know if it was going to take 2 weeks or 6 weeks sometimes, but it was really, really cheap.
It was, I wouldn't say cheap. It was enough where, from my opinion, it was enough to say, you know, one more thing that made that dollar figure move higher than I wanted it to. You know, buying things from Amazon, I'm so spoiled when I'm buying stuff from Amazon. So when I go outside of my comfort zone and buy things like that, I can't stand the charges. And this is going to make it even worse.
So it's good news for Amazon. Well, actually, no. Well, all right. So it's domestic. So yeah, it's still good news.
No. Actually, about 2 months ago, Amazon completely changed all of their back-end infrastructure to allow out-of-country parties to be prominent on the Amazon marketplace. Because if you notice, when you go to Amazon, it's very easy to buy things that are not sold by Amazon,
or Prime,
from Prime, which Prime just means easily, readily accessible to Amazon pipeline. They just opened it up a little bit ago. Some people believe that's why there's been a lot of things getting stopped on Amazon with reviews and the such, because they're trying to cut down on scams and people with ill intent on the network. Amazon and eBay just went through a tussle where one of them is blaming the other one for poaching international sellers, trying to literally intercept communications between them and say, hey guys, we'll give you a better rate. This all is going to impact everybody's bottom line. It's just a question of when and who's going to absorb the price. Hopefully it isn't just the consumer.
So I'm sure this, what you're talking about, in conjunction with the tariff wars, or scuffle, or whatever you want to call it, the higher tariffs, it's not going to make things any better.
Well, the only constant is change. And what I really hope is people and companies overreact to it, because then when things settle down, the prices won't be as bad. You know what I mean? Because we like overreacted. I don't think, here's the gimmick. I've followed too much news. The tariff, all the tariff stuff is going to basically just be offsetting. It's going to be like, we're going to tell a country, we're going to add 2 cups of water to your thing. And then they're going to say, well, we're going to add 2 cups of water to your thing. So it's tit for tat, tit for tat, tit for tat, tit for tat. So the actual money exchanging hands is going to end up being close to the same. It's just a, you know, who has the advantage today kind of thing. So I don't think that's going to affect stuff greatly, but I'm not a economist. And if any economist admits anything to you, the first thing they admit is they don't know what the hell they're talking about. Because there's way too many moving parts when it comes to economies and pricing and infrastructure and all the money that goes back and forth. It's really difficult to say anything with absolute assured. You know what I mean?
I get you. Well, thank you, Joe. I appreciate you bringing us into the fold on that one, because I did not know about that. That was good to know. Matter of fact, the only thing I've even heard of the UPU before, so I will definitely track this one.
I'm not going to lie. I had to look it up. And then when I saw the website, I thought, this isn't a real website. Right? This is a phishing scam. This thing looks like it's made with Front Page Express.
Oh, geez, yes.
I mean, it really does look horrible. I mean, it really, truly looks horrible. I mean, here's the thing. Hopefully, it's all running on HTML, so it's probably all static pages. So it's actually probably a safe website to go to, because it's not running JavaScript with jQuery follow-up loader. Have you heard about that one, Rich? Oh my goodness. No, it's actually an exploit that's 10 years old that they knew about 10 years ago, but they forgot to propagate correctly. So now over 80% of all jQuery instances, and there's over 800 active forks on GitHub of the jQuery file uploader, where you can upload malicious code and run remote code.
Oh boy.
Oh yeah, that's bad. That's bad. You want to talk about web developers going ballistic right now, going through upgrade paths? Oh yeah, right now should be the time.
So is that why you just Google instead of downloading jQuery onto your own site?
That's one of the, too deep to go into now. Kind of. Okay, if anybody wants to shoot an email, honestly, the best, most assured way to send an email is at doordoorgeek@gmail.com or mail at podnest.com. I'm still having issues. I'm only getting like 1 out of 3 of the mini PC show emails forwarded correctly. I don't know why. You can also send us a voicemail, 7076-PODNUT. You can still connect with us on Google+. And the advantage is every single day we have people leaving Google+, which just means it's easier and easier to make an impression and communicate with people on Google+. So enjoy us while we're there, because we are. Rich, do you have any parting words?
Just if you want to get a hold of me, flyingrich.com, there's a contact me page and all my social media is there. And so when you post this podcast, it'll be there also.
Very cool. Very cool. Brian?
Yeah, and I would have to say the same thing. I am not going anywhere on Google Plus. I am holding on to the last day. So if you want to find me, you can search Ask the Cable Guy and I'll be there.
Very cool. Yeah, it's like, Rich, I can't believe I can't remember his name. Ben-Hur.
From the Bible?
Well, the actor who played Ben-Hur.
Charlton Heston.
Oh,
Charlton Heston. You can take Google Plus out of my hands when I'm cold and dead. Yeah. Or like that. You know, I'll tell Facebook, get away from me, you damn dirty ape.
That's so perfect.
I seriously thank you guys for coming out. As always, really good to talk with you. If we miss things that we should have talked about, people, you got to let us know, and we will do our best to bring them up, and hope everyone has a good week.
This is Martin from PodNuts Pro. Thank you so much for choosing this podcast to be in your ears right now. Don't forget to support all the other PodNuts shows on the PodNuts Network, and we cannot do this without you. So please, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, email us at podnutspro@podnuts.com.